Wes Nguyen and I met through mutual friends back in October in New York City. We share a lot of the same passions, including cars, watches, and music, so it was only natural that we'd hit it off. With the growing number of watch dealers, I was excited to host Wes, who launched Collector's Corner New York only a few years ago after a career in the music business, which I was completely unaware of. Today, Wes focuses on the best examples of the pieces he sells, so rest assured if you're buying from him, he's done a ton of legwork for you already. His innate sense of research is apparent, as you'll soon hear, and he's one of the most down-to-earth people in the watch game, so I'm stoked to call him a friend. Per usual, the conversation twists and turns, including his collegiate-level squash game. I'm your host, Wesley Smith, and you're listening to the Standard H Podcast. Yo.
Wesley, what's going on, brother?
How are you, man?
I'm good.
Good, good. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you as well. I appreciate the fact that we're doing video. It makes it a little bit more intimate.
Yeah, it's easier to do these things for me with video anyway. I've done a couple where the guest has deactivated their camera and the game of tennis just isn't quite the same.
I hear you there, man.
Well, you and I are obviously on a pre-owned search for Porsches, a chat, you know. I feel like it's gone kind of quiet, though. So I'm kind of wondering what your take is on that.
Definitely. Well, I told our mutual friend, Raymond Milnark, I'm actually going to delay the car for a year. And it's been on my list for quite a while, but I've been very busy restoring my current car, which is something I'm sure we could talk about here.
Let's get into it.
It's an E39 540 M Sport final production year from 2003. And it was actually my father's car.
Oh, cool.
He didn't put very many miles on it. He was driving it to and from work early on, which was only about a mile and a half from our house. So when I started driving it more, I think it had probably 45,000 miles on it, and it was already 18 years old at that point. So it's been a very well-preserved car, black on tan. It's auto. You know, it's not a manual, but it's a perfect daily driver. So
yeah,
he just noticed that I was taking really great care of it over the last five or so years, and he actually gifted it to me for Christmas this year, which was amazing.
Wow.
It's a very sentimental car now, of course. It's my favorite BMW of all time.
Sure.
One of the last partially handmade BMWs as well. So yeah, I just spent quite a bit of time restoring it. I'm doing the timing chain guides this weekend, and I should be really off and running and set for like the next 10 years, hopefully, with this thing.
Now, are you doing the work or do you have a mechanic?
I'm having a mechanic do it. It's someone who's pretty reputable in the area in Connecticut here. And it was actually Raymond who recommended that I get some of the cosmetic work done that we did. He gave me a great person and we did a full paint correction on the car, PPF'd the entire front half of the car. So for any listeners who aren't familiar with PPF, it's paint protection film.
Right.
Just really sets up the paint for a long life. And we did a ceramic coating for 5-year protection. We refinished the wheels and the car just looks unbelievable. It presents so much better now.
I mean, obviously I'm privy to some of the photos and such of said work, and yeah, the car looks incredible. I don't recall seeing the interior though. So I guess I wasn't, maybe I knew that it was tan on the interior or not, but do you have like sort of a dream spec for cars in general? Like I remember when I had Eric Anders Lang on the podcast, he goes, "What's the correct interior color?" And at the time I was like, well, it depends on the exterior color, right? So like if you have, you know, some crazy combo going on, but I'd like to take that situation back and say tan is the correct interior color of an automobile.
I would say so, especially on the E39, right? For me, the interior of that car just is unbelievably comfortable. Mm-hmm. It's a real GT car, if you will. It's a gentleman's car. It's as impressive as any interior I've ever sat in. And I think it's probably my favorite car interior of all time as well. If it was really the dream spec, I would say maybe the green with tan, but the black with tan certainly gets the job done. And I'm a huge fan of course, of the turbos. I really, really love the 997s. I feel like those are the most attractive Porsche ever made. And for me, I'm not going to be quite as picky about the spec. I think you had Adam Golden on actually recently, and he was talking about how chasing the exact spec can get in the way of buying the car. So I decided when I go for that, it's going to be a .1, hopefully kind of like a final year Metzger engine, and just silver, like an Arctic silver or gray, I think would be perfect. And when you have a black car, it's a little difficult to keep clean. So that'll be a welcome change.
Yeah, for sure. I've had silver cars in the past, and they are the best with regards to looking cleaner the longest, you know. Yeah, that's great. And that's partially why I like white as well, is because I don't know if it's ironic or not, but coincidentally stays cleaner looking longer than, say, black, for example, which it's kind of like the opposite in clothes. You know, black looks good longer because if you spill something on your leg or something like that, like black jeans are not going to look dirty. So it is funny that it's sort of backwards, but
Totally.
that's cool. What was the difference between the 540 and say the M5? I know the M5, that body, that was the 400 horsepower, right?
Right. So the M5 was 395, let's say, and the 540 was about 290.
Okay, so it was 100 horsepower jump.
Yeah. And a lot of
Wow.
folks will say it's like 25% less in certain ways, right? You don't have an Alcantara headliner. The steering rack is technically better in the 540, and a lot of folks will say that the 540 is actually more reliable. Of course I would love to have an M5, but I think if I owned one, I probably wouldn't daily drive it. They've become a little bit too collectible at this point. I think down the road, maybe an E90 M3 would be great to add to the mix with a manual. I really love the slick top, non-navigation versions of those cars. It's very stripped back with no kind of analog, with no digital kind of dashboard at all. And for me, that car looks amazing in the Silverstone metallic color. It really kind of accentuates the aggressive angles. And I've had a lot of seat time in those. My dad has a E92, and we did like a high flow air intake and the M Sport exhaust, chip tune the engine, and easily one of the best sounding V8s I've ever driven.
Oh, amazing. What does your dad do? Do you mind me asking?
He's retired, but he was a wealth manager at Morgan Stanley for the last 20 years of his career.
Got it.
He focused a lot on commodities specifically, and gold and silver in particular.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah. So he's always been a car guy. Is that how you got to be sort of in the car interest?
Absolutely. I think I got it from him, and he managed to buy a XK120 Jag when he was 18 years old for $400, believe it or not.
Oh my God.
And we still have that car. It's in our garage up in Rhode Island.
Really?
Amazing car. Really, really beautiful. It's the one from Cruel Intentions for anyone listening that might not know the specific vehicle, but it's from 1951. And we have an E-Type Jag in British Racing Green, tan interior. That car has been restored to the nines. It's absolutely stunning, and I'm lucky to drive that once in a while.
So is that the coupe or is it the convertible?
It's the convertible.
Oh, okay. Cool. Amazing. I just okay, keep going, keep going. I'm like I want to say so much already. Keep going.
What else? We had a 456 Ferrari for about 10 years. One of my big collectible sales. My dad bought it on eBay, and I sold it for him on eBay about 9 or 10 years later, since we had owned it initially. And certainly kind of gave me the bug to get more into this stuff. I've been into bikes. I've had six different motorcycles. I have a Ducati Scrambler cafe racer right now, and I think I'm selling the bikes. There might be a kid in the slightly near future. So
Oh, okay.
I'm still
Understood.
riding for about 10 years, and no scrapes or anything. So I think it's time to move on to the car stuff.
Yeah, they've, I think, I don't know if I've mentioned this on the pod before or not, but they've always said, you know, there's two types of motorcycle riders. There's those who've been in accidents and those who will be. So if you've managed to get through this unscathed, that's I'd say that's a big win. So yeah, congrats.
Thank you. Thank you.
Amazing, man. Man, you've got a lot of fun stuff. I don't know that I've ever shared this, but one of my grail cars is an XK, an old Jag XK. And I would honestly take the 120, the 140, or the 150. And I guess not to make this about Standard H because this is really about you, but the reason the Targa Florio jacket has the numerical system on the tag, if people want to jump into that on the product page, the nomenclature used as 120 for the Targa Florio jacket derives from the XK120
Oh,
car.
wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so I'm obsessed. When I saw Cruel Intentions in 1997 or 98 or whenever that movie came out, like I was obsessed with that car. And it, to this day, like that spec black with the white walls, I would kill to have one of those. But I don't, what's the market on those now? Do you know? Like 100 grand?
Yeah, I think it's slower. And that car has not been driven in quite a while, actually. It needs some work, but you're welcome to our place up in Watch Hill. Ironically, my parents' house is in Watch Hill of all places. So it's a beautiful little town on the water, essentially, and very, very charming. The hotel called the Ocean House was in a Wes Anderson film, Moonrise Kingdom. It's a very iconic old hotel that was restored pretty recently in the last 20 years by a family friend of ours, and incredible spot. It's kind of like the main social hub in this tiny little beach town.
No way.
Welcome up there anytime, man.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah, dude, I'd be thrilled to do that. You mentioned Raymond. He and I have a little trip coming up in July, so maybe the three of us can make that happen.
We should absolutely do that. And hopefully, one of us has one of these 997s by that point.
Right. You know, it's funny. I think I've kind of pushed mine for the time being as well. As much as I want to, it's I have too much landscaping to do. You know, it's like, do I want a front yard or do I want a car? And it's like, well, you know, I guess priorities.
Time might be on your side too. I feel like the car market is it's slowed down a little bit. I'm actually after the convertible, so maybe those bump up a little bit in the spring here, but I just don't think the market on the dot ones is going to explode in the next 2 years.
Yeah.
And you're looking at a dot one as well, right?
Preferably, and it's almost entirely predicated on the rear tail lights because I just don't want LEDs. I think they look too new. It also disrupts the line of the bumper, you know. It's just little meticulous details that I obsess over and or get killed by, you know. So as you do.
Totally.
Man, that's exciting. So, how much time do you spend with your dad in these cars? Like, do you guys do cars and coffee, or are you guys going for drives, or?
So we've shared quite a bit of driving together. We've both done the Skip Barber defensive driving course, which is really fun.
Yeah.
In the relay race, I got to drive twice, so I got a really good bang for my buck on that course.
Awesome.
We did our motorcycle safety course together as well. So we've driven a lot together on the bikes. And it's just one of those things that we've connected on over the years. And once in a while, I'll send him a listing. I'm like, oh my gosh, look at this car. It's stunning. And he's obviously got great taste. I mean, he kind of ended up with a few things that he grew up loving. And cars are just another nostalgic thing for people, right? I think. For me, I love the cars I just listed because we grew up with them.
Yeah.
You know, for him, it was always the E-Type, essentially. Enzo Ferrari said that that was the most beautiful car ever made, and I'm
Yeah.
not going to disagree with that statement.
Yeah. I just took a ride last September in my first E-Type, up in Maine, and it was just an unbelievable experience. Like, it was just life just slows down and with the wind in your hair, like it's just like it was a movie, you know what I mean? Like it was amazing. You know, something I was just thinking about as you're talking about, like, kind of how you're experiencing all these things with your dad. So my dad and I never really shared those same types of passions when I was a kid. I always felt like I was interested in that kind of stuff, whereas it's not that he wasn't interested. It's just he just wasn't interested. You know, it wasn't like a negative thing. It was just a happenstance, you know. Do you find that, like, you kind of maybe held up his passion by you being interested? Or did you ever feel like he was sort of pushing you into the hobby? Or was it just completely natural and it's just we're just coexisting? And like how did it feel as a child or like even as a teenager to just like hang out with? Because most teenagers are like, Dad, I got to go hang out with my friends. You know what I mean? So like you guys seem really close. I think that's really special.
Totally. And we shared other hobbies, right? He taught me how to play guitar. So we definitely connected on that quite a bit. I think it all comes from just sort of naturally having an interest in something. So I was exposed to it. We would go to car shows together. And when you're a teenager learning how to drive, I think it's hard not to appreciate some beautiful cars around you. Mm-hmm. I think if we had more space, we would have done more with it and maybe gone to the track and things like that. But you know how it is. Life gets in the way and other priorities come into play.
Sure. What kind of guitars are you into? Is it acoustic stuff, electric? Is it everything? Is it Fender, Gibson?
Yeah, it's mostly Fender, I would say, but some Gibson. And we developed a really nice guitar collection, mostly of vintage stuff, as well as some rare vintage amps. And we had this space over our garage growing up, which we called the Bird's Nest. My nickname in high school was Bird.
Really? Why is that?
It's funny. I have bird-like features, you might say. But it was perfect because we could make as much noise as we wanted. So I was able to really blast the electric and had a loop pedal and would play concerts for all my friends when we'd hang out over the weekends. I played in a couple of bands. I played in a band called Mars Motel in New York City for a few years and really interesting, like indie rock sounding music.
What years was this?
This was from 2016 to 2019.
Oh, wow. So fairly recently.
Yeah, it was COVID kind of ended the band thing, but
sure.
I was really doing it for fun because I worked in the music industry for about a decade and it was a nice thing to kind of do on the side to just have a creative outlet, if you will.
Yeah.
But we did some great stuff. I mean, we played the Mercury Lounge and sold that out a handful of times.
Nice.
We did Bowery Ballroom, which is my favorite venue in New York City.
I've never been to a show there and I've always wanted to. It's just none of the bands that I've been interested in have been in town when I'm in town. So that's still kind of on the hit list for me.
You should absolutely do it. It's just one of the most balanced venues in terms of being kind of intimate, but just big enough to not have the wrong acoustics, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We also did Firefly Music Festival, produced a really, really beautiful album in Brooklyn. And it's called Passenger X. If anybody wants to check it out on Spotify.
Oh, sick. I'll definitely do that. I had no idea, man. That's awesome. What were you doing in the music industry?
I worked for Columbia Records for the better part of 7 years. And I actually sat on the marketing team. So I worked on a lot of interesting projects, mostly on like the research and analytical side, but, obviously the music industry has been so data driven with the advent of Spotify and all the DSPs like that. So it was a very interesting time to be in the business. When I came in 2012, Columbia was the number one market share label for that year, as well as like the next 5 years in a row, which was pretty amazing to be a part of that.
Wow.
And just a really nice, diverse group of artists on the roster. We had Daft Punk, Beyonce, Foster the People. You know, we had indie acts like Ms. Mister and St. Lucia, just a really, really amazing group of artists.
Yeah, that's incredible. I'll cut this out. But so the drummer for Foster the People used to be in a band called Malbec, like the grape. And so when I was out in LA looking for a job, I happened to go in. Do you know Jay Lindeberg, the brand? It was like Jesper Parnevik used to wear it on the PGA Tour, and now Victor Hovland wears JL.
For sure.
Well, they had a store at Beverly Center, and there was a guy working there named Pablo, and he's like, I was just, again, researching. I was like trying to figure out, like, can you live in LA on the salary of a retail employment type of situation? And, you know, just trying to do my due diligence. And he's like, yeah, man, but I'm also in a band called Malbec, and Pablo is the lead singer. Well, and it ended up being a couple months later, I ended up moving to LA, and Pablo and I kept in touch, and he's just like, hey man, like, I'm playing this show at the Viper Room, you should come. And I was like, cool. So I went to that, and then they were like, hey dude, we're having this like house party, you should come. And so I was like, so the band breaks up, and next thing I know, the drummer is like the drummer for Foster the People, and Foster the People blows up. And I was like, oh my God, like I saw that guy playing in a living room like 2 years ago. Like, you know, it was crazy. So anyway, that's sort of my Foster the People story, but like,
no, that's a good one.
That's crazy. So how did you get in with Columbia then?
So I got lucky. I think a couple of my friends growing up had folks who were in the industry and their families. So I actually worked at Rolling Stone for a summer. One of my good friends was related to Jan Winner, and I managed to get an internship over there. I did that between my two internships at Columbia. One of my best friends growing up, his father used to run Columbia Records, and probably one of the most storied record executives in the history of recorded music. I mean, he managed Elton John, AC/DC, I believe Deep Purple as well. He ran Epic Records, then he ran Columbia, and then he ran Capitol Music Group in LA, and just retired about, I want to say, a year and a half ago.
Wow.
But I grew up going over to their house and got to know him very well. And I was lucky. I was one of the very, very few people that he actually hired. And I was his direct research person when I started off at Columbia.
So what do you research in that role? Like what is your day like?
Well, so we can tie this into watches, because I think the watch thing really, really melds well with the whole research theme of my previous career.
Certainly.
Music and in the tech space, actually. But in researching music, we would be looking at like all the drivers and the tentpole events that would help build an artist's career. I mean, just talking about Foster the People, for instance, you could look at the music consumption on Shazam and all the DSPs and on the sales side and the streaming side, at the time of an event, like going on a TV, a TV promo or a radio promo, anything that we were spending marketing dollars on, we wanted to see kind of what the ROI was, but it certainly was very valuable information. I mean, I remember putting together a marketing plan actually for Adele's 21, which was definitely the biggest thing that I worked on in my career.
Yeah.
I had to present it to Adele's manager, Jonathan Dickens, in front of like all the top Sony execs. But we really dug into all of the previous history with her, because they wanted to make sure that everything was locked in terms of the right marketing events, as well as promotion and publicity, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, how old are you at this time?
I was young. I think 25 probably at that time. Yeah.
Was it nerve-wracking? Like, I mean, you're so young, or were you just like so dialed into what you were doing? It's like data's data. So it's like, I just got to present the data.
I mean, it was nerve wracking. The personalities are big, but at that point, I already knew the CEO of Columbia Records pretty well. I'd interned working for him, not directly, but interfacing with him in the previous summers. So big personality, absolutely one of the most incredible human beings I've had the pleasure of knowing in my life. Just such an eloquent speaker, and just led the ship at Columbia like to an unbelievable degree. Wow. And now he actually runs all of Sony Music, which is incredible.
Yeah. So when you mentioned Shazam, how does a record label measure ROI on Shazam?
It's a good question. I mean, it shows call to action, right? So if you hear a song on the radio and you actually go to Shazam the song, it's just showing additional interest in that song, right? So if you see a lot of tags off of a certain amount of radio exposure, let's say like a couple million in audience, mm-hmm. you could take that and create a ratio of Shazams per million in audience. And that would give you like a metric, if you will, on the attention that that song is garnering.
Well, so the other thing is too, is like when I think of Shazam, I also think that I'm usually in a place other than my home, obviously, or even my car. Like I'm usually in a bar or like, God forbid, the grocery store. You know what I mean? Like, I hope I'm not Shazamming music in a grocery store. My life is pretty pathetic. But is there any GPS data too to drive those numbers? Like, how do you know where they are? Like, how is that?
Yeah, yeah. It's geotagged for sure. And it gets very localized in terms of the markets as well.
Wow. Man, that's some crazy insight. Interesting.
Yeah. So obviously the tastes change between all the markets in the US and internationally. Yeah. Certain artists would perform well in the UK and maybe not so much in the US. Mm-hmm. All those types of trends would come into play when it would come to marketing an artist on a global level as well, of course.
Yeah. Wow, that's insane. So are you going to pick up the guitar again? Are you going to start a new band? I mean, COVID's kind of come and gone, obviously, so...
I don't think I'm going to be starting a band. I don't have as much time these days just running CCNY, but it's my personal kind of escape, right? Like I can turn on my amp and set up loops and just play. And I'm sure I'll make another album at some point. I made a solo album as well as a tribute record to my favorite artist, who was the Red Hot Chili Peppers guitar player, John Frusciante.
Yeah.
A few cool projects that I've done, and it was just kind of bucket list stuff for me. I had to do it because I played guitar for so long.
Wow. So was there vocal involved or was it just instrumental, the solo record?
Yep. Yeah, yeah. I sing too.
Oh, sick. That's amazing. Does that little room of yours have a drum kit?
So not in this spot. A lot of the music I'll do is up in Rhode Island because we have the space to do it.
Okay.
But I'll even open up our door and just kind of like blast to the neighborhood. I used to do that back in Connecticut where my parents lived and never had any complaints so far. So it didn't sound terrible.
That's amazing. That's great. It's like busking from your house, but not getting paid.
Exactly.
That's crazy. Okay. So CCNY, vintage watch dealership, let's call it. It seems to be a growing number of you guys, you know, it just feels like there's, and this is no shade. It's just kind of an observation, you know, as a watch enthusiast myself. And it's kind of like, it's either new guys are popping up, and by guys, sorry, I don't mean to sound like new people are popping up, or people are leaving partnerships to do their own thing.
Totally.
You know, so why do you feel like there's been this rise in this population?
Well, a couple of things. I think watches are a phenomenal collectible because they're so easy to store mm-hmm. compared to a car, for instance. But mm-hmm. they also relate to so many different industries and facets of various parts of life, like fashion. You have the technical stuff like the astronauts were using them, divers in the 60s. You have race car drivers. There are a lot of different parts of culture that relate to watches. Mm-hmm. From my perspective, I think a lot of it obviously has to do with the fact that Instagram has helped promote watches over the internet. And the market has grown organically because there's so much content being produced about watches, mm-hmm. which is healthy for the market. You know, obviously the modern market has reset, if you will. I don't think it's crashed at all. I think it's just a natural sort of reset based on the overpriced stuff we saw during COVID. But, you know, I think that as more content comes out, and it will continue to be the case because you see more and more YouTubers and folks creating podcasts about watches, that scholarship is going to help develop the market, and you're going to see more real collectors come into the space, which so far in 24, I can say a lot of the speculation's already gone probably in the market. And it feels like it's just real collectors who are passionate about the watches themselves and not talking about the prices so much.
So when you say reset, is that kind of what you're referring to? You don't necessarily mean a market correction financially, or is it both?
I would say it's a different timing, right? Like the watch market came down precipitously in 2022. It was probably February that it really started coming down. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of folks asked me about this, but it was really like overhyped watches that were overpriced at that time because of dealer to dealer trading. Those had to settle back down to their intrinsic value, if you will, right? And mm-hmm. as a dealer, I kind of have a gut feeling for what I should pay for something. And it just felt like, you know, a Panda Daytona at 50 grand did not make any sense. Mm-mm. And I think that's a watch that should settle down in like the high teens probably at some point here.
Wow. Interesting. Was there someone that you sort of looked up to and or had as kind of a mentor as far as like selling watches goes?
Yeah. So I've mentioned on Collector's Gene Radio, I just was on Cameron Steiner's podcast there. Skip Powell was one person who really helped me get into the business and really understand what it's like to be a real full-time watch dealer. Mm-hmm. He's a phenomenal guy, one of my best friends, actually. And he just happens to be one of the top four-digit Rolex experts in the world, as well as Tudor. Hmm. Eric Wind is another mutual friend of ours. And I reached out to him actually very early on and been following him for years. But
sure,
he was super helpful and kind of like guiding me on my website early on and just gave me a ton of amazing advice to start. So a big thank you to Eric. And then James Lambden, of course, is another mutual friend. So James obviously runs Analog Shift in New York City and has a huge retail presence around the world with Watches of Switzerland, of course. So he really took me under his wing as well.
What are some nuggets of advice that you've received then, be it from Eric or anybody else?
I would say not to get too aggressive on pricing, right? You don't want to be too expensive because that makes watches sit for too long. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a balance too, because if you want to warranty a watch, you have to make a certain amount of margin on it. If something goes wrong at some point, you want to be able to go back and take care of the client without asking them for additional funds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think if you look at the market, there's kind of two buyers. There are price buyers and there are condition buyers. My business is way more focused on the condition buying front. And from my perspective, that's just kind of the right way to do vintage. I would rather pay a little bit extra for an unbelievable example of a watch versus just getting like an average example, because what tends to happen is you'll purchase that watch and then a few months later, you'll kind of forget what you paid for it and you'll be left with like an average example of that piece.
Yeah. What got you into watches to begin with? Was that another thing you shared with your dad or?
So I think a lot of it came from my interest in mechanical things growing up, of course, like cars and guitars and mm-hmm. music and all this stuff. But I was past my grandfather's vintage Rolex date, which I remembered seeing him wear that watch pretty much every day. So of Amazing. Course, super, super sentimental. And I just wore that on my wedding day a couple of years ago now. So yeah, that was the watch to wear when I got married for sure.
Oh, that's awesome. What was the first watch you sold? Do you remember?
I do remember. It was a Zin Mother of Pearl dial watch, actually, a Zin.
Wow.
Pretty interesting watch. And I started off selling like much cheaper watches. I didn't really want to dive in head first and take losses by not authenticating stuff correctly. And, you know, as you kind of build your business, your confidence on the buying side becomes much stronger. And, you know, I do sell watches that are like in the high five-figure range, low six-figure range occasionally. And I can tell you that it's nerve-wracking sourcing a watch like that when you're still kind of new in the space. But at this point, I'm much more confident in my buying. And, you know, I would say that my main focus is probably in like the 5 to 25K range right now.
Okay.
That is a very liquid part of the market. It doesn't require too much risk from a monetary standpoint. And it's just a little bit more accessible, because when you look at stuff like in the 50 to 75K range, the market just starts to get pretty thin up there.
Yeah. Yeah. So are you brand sort of agnostic then, even though it's kind of funny because you're focused on condition, but then you just stated sort of like these bookends of price from 5 to 25, which is great. You know, I mean, that's a great space to be in. There's plenty to choose from. Are there certain brands you consider yourself not proficient, maybe is the wrong word, but maybe focused on?
Sure. So my goal with the business is really to have a pretty diverse offering of brands and models. Mm-hmm. I've sold a lot of different types of brands, of course, if you look at my site, but obviously Rolex is a big one. I'm doing a lot more Patek lately. I think that the dress watch market is quite hot this year and should continue to be so. Cartier is big. I've been focusing on Cartier a lot for the last year or so. Mm-hmm. But you'll find really kind of like off the beaten path stuff as well, like Icapod, Tree Lobe. I have a Hodinkee limited of 30 pieces listed right now for that brand. Sold a lot of Hoyer, Piaget, Gallet, Audemars Piguet, Blancpain, neo vintage stuff, I think is pretty hot. Have a couple of those. I love UG pole routers. I'm about to list another one of those right now. I've got a rose one and a tropical dial. And then just like interesting kind of affordable finds. I really love alarm watches. I think they're highly undervalued still, and just a complication that's actually kind of fun and practical to use.
Mm-hmm. JLC or what's your favorite?
Probably JLC makes the best, but obviously Vulcain is sort of well known in that space. You know, Gerard Perregaux made a lot of great ones as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're great. I mean, it's perfect for like the enthusiast that's kind of getting into vintage, wants to buy something that's in really nice condition, but it's not going to break the bank.
If you have 10 grand, what are you buying right now? As a buyer, not as a seller.
So I mentioned Blancpain. I think their flyback chronographs represent incredible value. If I'm not mistaken, their movement is still the thinnest flyback chronograph movement to date.
Hmm.
And you can look at like the early 2000s ones in steel. You know, on bracelet, the bracelet quality is pretty much Rolex level. And you're looking at probably a third of the price of a Daytona, essentially, which it competed with to some degree. So really, really high-end watchmaking for well under 10 grand for an amazing chronograph.
That's really, really cool. I'm not familiar with like early 2000s Blancpain, honestly. I mean, obviously, you know, like 50 Fathoms is kind of the flagship, obviously. So
yeah,
that's sort of where the main exposure has been for me personally. As far as replacing your inventory goes, obviously you sell a watch, you make a little money, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
But this is sort of on the heels of another question that I kind of skipped over, but which is you had somewhat of a nice feature for those who watch Adam Golden's YouTube channel. Like you were pretty present in his Miami Antique Show sort of roundup video, which was great because it was cool because I didn't know you were going to be on it, and up comes your face. And I was like, oh my God, I was like, it's Wes.
It's hilarious. Yeah.
So how did that unfold? And like, did you guys plan on shooting that, or was that completely organic, or had that come
about? Yeah, it was organic. I mean, I made a point to go say hi to Adam first and foremost. I was like looking forward to catching up with him a little bit. And he asked me first, he said, is it okay if we do YouTube? And
yeah,
look, I think Miami is an interesting show. I did an article about it in my field notes section on my website. Recommend going and checking that out if you didn't get filled in on the event, but it's just one of the best places to go hunt watches, but also like catch up with everyone in the industry that you don't see every day. And I think from a selling standpoint, it's a little bit more difficult selling dealer to dealer versus like going to buy. So my focus in that trip was really trying to buy watches and find stuff from like estate jewelers, which thankfully I had a couple of really, really great finds. But yeah, the video is just all organic and it's cool. I mean, look, you know, I think Adam is always looking to stock interesting watches at the right price. And I think a lot of folks out there don't realize that the buy price might be a little lower than one might expect if you carry an inventory like he does, which is quite substantial.
Yeah. Do you remember what you funded your business with, if you don't mind me asking? Like, what did you start with?
It was not as much as you would expect. I think it was like 40 grand I started with. So,
wow.
You know, from my perspective, you don't need a lot of capital to start, but you're going to have to work really hard to flip your inventory and get your name out there.
Yeah.
There's not a day that I don't work. I mean, I focus like 90% of my energy on selling watches.
Right. Okay. So, and 10% on sourcing, I guess.
I just mean that from like a general business standpoint, right? But there's a lot that goes in, right? Like there's sourcing great inventory. Mm-hmm. You have to research it and authenticate it and make sure that it's correct. You might have to service it, of course, too. Mm-hmm. I still handle all of my own photography in terms of shooting because I really love the creative process of that.
Yeah, cool.
But I just hired a contractor to help me on the editing side for all the photography. And then, of course, you need to write it up and list it and field inquiries and, you know, make sure that you're placing watches in the right areas, too, because I might have inventory that I want to sell privately. I might want to wholesale. I'm also sourcing watches between days of selling at retail just to kind of like keep the lights on, if you will, too. So mm-hmm. There's a lot of sourcing requests right now that I need to fill. And, you know, it takes time. You got to kind of like make sure that every single client is happy. You don't want to have anybody left with any kind of negative taste.
Sure, sure. What was there like a pivot point, or like when did you know that you wanted to do this full time? Like when and how did you decide?
So the business actually started almost by accident. I was following the watch industry for like 15 years, right? I'd been aware of vintage watches, been reading about them for a long time, and was collecting casually in New York City, you know, just buying like cheaper micro brands and kind of just experiencing the world of going to meetups and stuff like that, mm-hmm. probably in the late teens, especially. But a buddy of mine found a rare watch like at a tag sale. And I told him, I was like, man, we could probably start a business just selling this watch, you know? So he was involved early on. He ended up having to leave the business for health reasons, but I decided just to move on and try to take it into full time. And mm-hmm. thankfully it's been great. You know, it's been full time for a few years now, actually. So
that's amazing. What sort of percentage, I guess you could say, of your business is sort of business to business versus direct to consumer? Because I know networking is huge. You mentioned Eric, you mentioned James, you mentioned Adam. Like, you know, and obviously with the video and stuff, like you do find yourself in these positions where you could be selling to another dealer. What's sort of the breakdown there?
Yeah, I think probably 15% is B2B wholesale. Maybe another 15% is sourcing watches directly for clients. And then the rest of the 70 is just pure retail.
Got it. Cool. Is it easy to follow trends by way of what's being requested? Or do you ever steer a client when they say, I'm trying to source X, and you're like, well, let me show you over here.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
Look, I love modern watches. I'm never going to sort of talk down on modern watches. I think everybody should own at least one modern watch just to kind of wear as a daily driver.
Sure.
But, you know, I have a lot of folks coming to me being like, hey, I want to get a Batman GMT. And I'll ask them, I'm like, why do you want to get that watch? And they have no answer for me. They're like,
really?
Yeah, because like my friend has one and I think it looks interesting. And I'm like, look, I think the Batman is a great watch, but it's actually not really even part of Rolex's previous history. You know, you might argue the Pepsi is more relevant to some degree because of that. So,
sure.
That was one client where I steered him a little bit, and he ended up taking an unpolished Kermit with a Mark III bezel that I absolutely loved. And he seems really happy with it. I told him, I was like, look, you know, this is actually a 50th anniversary Submariner piece. It's one of the very few models that Rolex advertised as an anniversary model. So I've always thought that the Kermits were special, and I think they're going to be just essentially like the last truly collectible sub, because they have enough variation in them over the years that you can collect the different variants.
Oh, that's interesting, because like, I'm such a sucker for color, and I'm not a guy who would ever buy a Kermit based on the green itself. I love the watch, mind you. Like, I think it looks great. I just don't think I would sink that kind of cash into that kind of watch personally based on color alone.
And that's okay, by the way. Like, for me, yeah, the green is also important because it's technically Rolex's brand color.
Yeah, totally. And their 50th anniversary. I think it wasn't the milk. So I think I've just said this recently, the Milgauss with the black dial and the green glass, when that was first launched, if I'm not mistaken, not only is it my favorite variant, but I think the green glass came out as the 50th anniversary for that watch, right? Or is that wrong?
I actually don't know. I'd have to look back into some research on that, but I have somebody looking for one right now, and it's been harder to find a nice example than I would have thought.
Yeah.
The GV green glass it's tough to replace. From my understanding, if you break it, I think it's very expensive to replace.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. It's also interesting that the Rolex building is like the glass of the, there's so much glass around that building. It very much looks the same. I don't know if you've seen pictures or been there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But I wonder if, I mean, I'm sure it's done on purpose, but I've always found that to be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but as far as like the Batman goes,
sure.
You know, initially I preferred the Batman even over the Pepsi, just because like, I wasn't really sure about the red.
Yeah.
You know, just being such a vibrant color. So blue black sort of was just the more under the radar look if you didn't want a Submariner. Like in certain lights, the blue black can kind of look all black, and there's just so much design language sort of overlap with a Submariner, I think, with that GMT.
Absolutely.
That was the only reason why I think some, including myself, may have chosen that one. But But I mean, I think your argument's a good one. You know what I mean? Like, get something that's got more history involved. Like, if you're steering someone away from modern and towards vintage, I think that was a compelling statement for sure.
Right.
Not that you need my approval.
I'm not a huge fan of red personally, so I probably wouldn't own a Pepsi myself. Something that was blue and just like easier to wear.
Yeah, yeah.
And not to backpedal or pull myself out of a hole if you own one, but like, I think that the Batman is probably a lot easier to wear than a Pepsi in everyday life. So yeah. I think that's why it's so popular, probably.
Yeah. 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 Or if you're Duke Blue Devil, you know. Speaking of music and all that, what was the first album you ever bought with your own money?
I remember the first few, actually. It was Nirvana In Utero. That's a phenomenal album.
Sure.
And I had Third Eye Blind, I think. I forget the name of the record, but it was like their blockbuster record that had all those hits.
Yeah.
Gosh, I mean, I just remember like my parents essentially giving me a booklet of CDs to listen to. And I ended up just taking all the classic rock and really delving into that, especially.
So the Deep Purples of the world, did you get into them?
More like the Eagles, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And I still love the Eagles. I mean, Allman Brothers, my mom loves David Gilmour, and I was lucky to see him play MSG. He did Dark Side of the Moon straight through. It was one of the most incredible concerts I've ever been to.
Amazing.
Neil Young, I have to mention, Crybaby Neil.
Yeah.
Mom would say. You know, my parents had great taste in music. I think that was passed on to me. And, you know, it's one of those things that it's, you're going to get it by just being exposed to it in your life.
Yeah. Wrapping up here, I've got one more question for you, because this is also one I'm not sure I've ever asked before, but it's one I've talked about like in life. If you could go back and live any age over again, how old would you be?
Oof, that's a good one. I think I would be 22 years old again.
What happened at 22?
It's just a really fun time in your life. I mean, I think it's a time when you think that life will go on forever. And sadly, that's not the case. Mm. But you're kind of like a young adult. You're figuring out who you are still. It's just a very exciting time to be growing up, you know, in your low 20s. And you're obviously still developing yourself, right? Like there are challenges at that time of your life, but yeah. I would go back to that time for sure.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And I played squash there, and they had an interesting story with the squash team. They were the longest winning streak in college sports history. So if you look it up, my coach actually just retired, who ran the program for the last 30 some odd years there.
Wow.
It was 252 consecutive matches, one in a row. And I was very lucky to be there, like at an exciting time. It was the 10th national championship when I was a freshman. And then after I'd left, it was like 14. So really, really amazing program. We had people from all over the world too. It was like,
yeah,
to see in Squash Magazine in India. I remember seeing this guy, Manik Mathur, who he's now like the one or two doubles player in the world, but I grew up looking at him like on the cover of Squash Magazine, and then he was my team leader in college, which was unbelievable.
Squash Magazine. Okay, so my introduction to squash, I think, was... So my grandfather and I used to play racquetball together when I was like a kid. And then he and I were golfers as well, but we went to England. Like my first trip to England, I was 11 years old, and I went with my grandparents. And I played with this kid who ended up becoming a pen pal of mine. His name was John Williamson. John, if you're out there, we're 30 years removed from writing each other to Bishop Stortford, England. But yeah, I played squash with this kid, John, in England. And like, I always associate it with very much outside of the US. Because I always think of like racquetball being more of like the US maybe based indoor racquet sport. But like, how did you start playing squash? And I had no idea that, I mean, is that a big component of collegiate sports?
It's not really. I mean, there isn't even like a separate division. There's really only one division.
Okay.
A lot of people play on the East Coast, especially, I would say.
Sure.
But most of the players that are world renowned are like, they're Canadian. They're coming from South America. South Africa is a big squash hub, believe it or not. Hmm. Egypt, Australia, and the UK especially. But my dad, again, had started playing squash. Like, he went to Trinity as well, but he started playing, I think, right after Trinity. Got me into it when I was in my lower teens. I ended up loving it, and just a really fun way to get through college. It kept me in line, I would say, too, because we would train literally 6 days a week. So you had to have your shit together.
Yeah. I guess it's a pretty high endurance sport, I guess. Like but it's also sort of like stop and go the way football is. Like, you know, you got to serve and do the rest, but it's like, so your fast twitch muscles have got to be on point. What was training like, just aside from playing, obviously?
Training was intense. I mean, we would do all sorts of stuff. Like, they would put us into the Olympic size pool and make us tread water until we couldn't anymore.
Really?
Yeah. It was all really endurance based stuff. We would do long distance runs together, a lot of drills. And it was exciting, though. I mean, it was all worth it because we had a lot of people watch the matches too. We'd have big matches and 2,000 people would come in and watch us play, which is kind of surprising. I mean, you know, the football team was obviously very popular at Trinity, but we'd get a lot of those folks watching squash too.
That's amazing. So just big, huge acrylic glass, whatever, windows to take a peek through. That's insane.
Yeah, we had two courts that were totally glass, so you could watch from essentially every angle. And then most of the courts are just glass back, so you can watch from the back.
Whoa, if it's all glass, that like, that'd feel like a video game.
It's harder. The ball is white and the walls are blue, so it's actually harder to see the ball. It doesn't bounce quite as hard in the full glass court either.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be like the top matches would end up in the exhibition courts.
Was that unique to Trinity, or did every university have like all glass walls?
So some had them and some didn't, but I would say that Trinity had some of the best just in terms of the angles that you could view the game. And yeah, just, you know, that was many years ago at this point.
Yeah.
I'm not playing as much squash. I play more doubles these days than anything, because it's a little easier on the body.
Sure.
But great thing to do. And, you know, just one of those things that, like, Columbia was such an honor to be a part of that program.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's why I like doing these shows, man. They always take twists and turns that I don't see coming. That's cool. Yeah. Well, Wes, man, this is fun. I really appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you the next time I'm in the city, obviously.
Of course.
And yeah, man, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much for having me on, brother. And just give me a heads up when you're on this side of the country. We got to get you out to Rhode Island too. I'd love to have you out for a drive.
Oh yeah, let's do it for sure, 100%.
Thanks so much, Wesley. Take care, man.
This wraps up this episode of the Standard Age Podcast. If you like what you heard, I'd love it if you'd share it with a friend or two. And if you have a moment, please rate and review the show, as it helps others discover these episodes. It absolutely helps far more than you realize. Shout out to Jensen Reed and Super Beautiful for the theme track. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you in the next one. Take care.